So what Watson and Crick revealed was the nature of how the code was put into the blueprint. It was the sequencing of those four bases, A, T, C, and G, so that all of a sudden the genetic code was broken. I remember back in 1953, being relatively younger then, the headline that came out in the New York paper was a tabloid, and the entire front page in giant block letters was, "Secret of Life Discovered." And from that point on, biology has been so wrapped up in the genes, because after 100 years from Charles Darwin's suggestion that heredity was carried by substance in the germ cells, we finally identify what that substance is and know the code. And science was really excited because, remember, science's mission statement was to dominate and control nature. With the finding of an understanding of the genetic code, scientists saw that, oh, the future, the mission that they've been working on was really near, that by understanding the nature of the genetic code, that we could change the characters of organism, change the traits, and therefore we would succeed in the mission of what? Dominating and controlling nature. So there was a big headlong rush into the Human Genome Project to try to understand the nature of the genes. And the relevance about all this is that when we started to step back and say, well, what did we find? We found that the traits of an organism are controlled by the genes that are transmitted from parent to child, and the genes were more or less the fate of an individual. So that conventional belief was that at the moment of fertilization, you get a set of genes from your mother, you get a set of genes from your father, the two come together, and then from that set of genes, it presents a program or fate map of the future of that individual. At first, we thought these genes only control just the physical form. But the more they started to manipulate the genes, they also started to see that there were influences on behavior and influences on emotion. So all of a sudden, the genes take on more profound meaning in our new world of biology, because all of a sudden, it describes all the characters and traits of a human are apparently controlled by these genes. Well, what's interesting was that science didn't really stop at that point. Francis Crick and James Watson said, wait a minute, the DNA is the blueprint for the protein. The proteins are the physical elements that give us our behavior and give us our structure, so that the DNA is pre-coding our behavior and our structure. And yet the one last question was, well, if DNA controls the proteins and the proteins control life, one last question is, what is it that controls the DNA? Because that would be going up to the last rung of the ladder to find out what is ultimately in control. Well, they did an experiment on that double helix. Remember I said there were two helical chains of DNA and wrapped around each other? That the DNA helix, each chain is a sequence of A, T, C's, and G bases that have a unique sequence for each gene. And what they found is that in the two chains that make up the helix, one chain is a physical complement of the other chain, so that they're not two random chains of DNA. In chain A, the bases that are lining from one end to the other of the chain are complemented by bases on chain B, the other piece of the DNA. What this really means is that one side of the DNA helix may have the linear code for a protein, might be the blueprint for the protein. The other side is a physical complement. Now, what I mean by physical complement is simply this. The chains are made out of these bases, which are A, T, C, and G, adenine, thymine, cytosine, and guanine. But what it turns out is that an adenine will plug into a thymine, a guanine will plug into a cytosine. And the same thing, the TA, thymine and adenine, will always complement each other, and the GC pairs will always complement each other. So on chain A, let's just say I have the following base sequences, A, T, C, and G. The complement strand, the other strand of DNA, will have the complete complement. So the complement of A is T, the complement of T is A. And so basically, what I start to find is that, well, I have A, T, C, and G on one side. I have T, A, G, and C on the other side. Basically, what it says is that the two strands are mirror images of each other. Well, that might sound complicated. Just understand this, that they are complements. So here was the last experiment that really shaped modern biology. They split up a DNA helix into A strands and B strands and separate them. So they only have a single strand. And let's say they take the A strand and they stick it into a beaker with all the building blocks of DNA, all those A, T, C, and G subunits. When they put the A strand and just soak it in that beaker with all the subunits and leave it for a short time and then pull that A strand out, what they find is that the A strand will actually serve as a template to code the B strand. And so what I put in as a single strand, when I pull it back out, is a double-stranded DNA again. And that the second strand is a physical complement of the first strand. So that what this really revealed was DNA was responsible for copying itself. So if you take a DNA molecule and split it up, each of the two chains will then form a complementary chain and repair themselves so that you end up with two double helices. So that in a cell, a chromosome will have two double helical strands. The chromosome will split into two, and then each of the strands will make a complement of itself, and then you end up with two chromosomes. One of them will go in the one daughter cell, one will go into the other daughter cell. The conclusion of this experiment was basically very fundamental and very important in shaping the biology we have, because it said this: DNA controls the protein, and the protein represents our bodies. And DNA controls itself, meaning that DNA is responsible for replicating its own self. So immediately what they said is, oh my goodness, that's the whole hierarchy of information. DNA controls itself, and DNA controls the protein. And that led Francis Crick to describe what is called the central dogma. And this is what I was teaching in medical school. The central dogma is this: that the flow of information in biology goes from DNA to RNA, and RNA is like a Xerox copy of the DNA, and that the RNA is used as the physical template to make the protein. So basically, the unfoldment of information is DNA goes to RNA, goes to protein. We, our physical bodies and our behaviors, reflect the protein part. But then when people say, well, where did you get your physical traits? Where did you get your behavioral traits that are manifest in the proteins? The answer is you go back up the ladder and you say, well, the proteins were coded from the RNA, but the RNA is a copy of the DNA. And so basically it says that life is controlled by DNA. That is the central dogma. And the relevance about that is that once we start to believe that, then we believe also in what is called the primacy of DNA, which is another way of saying the same thing in textbooks. Primacy meaning first cause. So when they say, well, tell me about that trait or character that you express in your life, and then a scientist would have to say, well, the first cause, the primary reason, is the DNA, because the DNA is responsible for giving us the pattern and shape of the proteins, which in turn give us the characters of our lives. So the central dogma supports a concept called the primacy of DNA that says who and what we are and the fate of our lives that we lead are already pre-programmed in the DNA that we received at conception. Well, stop about this for a second and say, well, what is the consequence of this? What does this mean in our personal lives? Well, we can step back and we talk about something that science refers to as genetic determinism. This is the belief that the character and the fate of your life are already determined or described in the genes you received at fertilization. So that more or less that as the genes come together during conception, your fate is already being written in that genetic code. Well, the significance about that is when we step back and say, well, wait, the things that go on in your life, the characters and traits, you may be happy with them, you may not be happy with them, but then apparently they appear to be related to the DNA. And then I say, well, as far as you know, did you pick the DNA that you came with? And the answer is, no, not really. But if the DNA provides for characters in your life that you don't like, can you change that DNA? And the answer is, no, not really. And all of a sudden you start to realize something, that the character and fate of your life reflects the heredity that you were born into, the lineage, that you are actually a victim of heredity, that you yourself didn't pick the traits, but the genes are going to control them. I mean, for example, every trait that we found in the human body, there have been biologists trying to identify the genes that control them. We see that virtually every day in the papers, in the media. A gene has been found to be associated with this, and a gene has been found to be associated with that. And all these traits that we're looking at appear to be written in genes. For example, scientists actually got together and looked at a group of people and scored them on the basis of happiness and tried to find out whether there was a gene that was associated with happy people that wasn't active in unhappy people. And sure enough, when they got enough happy people, they found a particular gene that seems to be more active in the happy people, and they immediately put out a big news media blip on gene for happiness discovered. And so essentially what they were trying to suggest was that the amount of happiness an individual can express in their life was genetically determined at the moment of conception. Well, all of a sudden you say, well, wait a minute. If I got a sucky happy gene, then my whole life is going to be predetermined on the basis of this heredity factor. I'm a victim of my heredity. Well, when people start to really own this, and this is exactly what we teach in school, and this is what I was also teaching in medical school, that people are controlled by these genes, then people start to realize that, in some sense, they're very powerless over their own life because they didn't pick the genes, they can't change the genes, and the genes apparently control who they are, so that's your fate right there. And when people start to recognize the nature of being powerless, they also start to become irresponsible, meaning, well, if I can't change it, I can't do anything about it, then who cares and why should I even bother? And all of a sudden we start to see people giving up on their lives as saying, well, it's out of my hands, it's out of my control, I have nothing to do with this. And then also making excuses for their lives by saying, well, look, I know, boss, you're calling me lazy, you know, but I just want you to know my father was lazy. My father, he was a sloth. What can you expect from me? I mean, it's genes made me lazy. I can't do anything about it. So basically, the population has really given themselves up. And science hasn't really helped because science keeps trying to suggest that we're victims of everything, that cancer cells are victimizing us, or disease cells are victimizing us, or that bacteria can kill us, and that be afraid of this and be afraid of that because we are these, you know, just these biochemical machines and very frail, and that nature can override this machine. And so we built into our lives the belief of victimization. I mean, even recently in Newsweek, they were talking about how fat cells are waging war on our health. And it's interesting because, well, in this epidemic of obesity, science stands back and says, well, it has nothing to do with you. It's your fat cells that are waging war in your life. So there's a tendency for us to let go of control and perceive ourselves as our fate being predetermined by the genes, and we're just trying to make the best we can out of life. And then when something goes wrong, of course, we have to go to a physician to try to get our chemistry and our genes to work more effectively to give us a better shot at life on this planet. So we feel victim to our genes, and as a result, we really express a concept of powerlessness, which is obviously very detrimental in trying to carry out your life. However, to come and save us, the Human Genome Project entered into our world. And it's interesting because even when the Human Genome Project was announced, I even thought, well, this is a humanitarian project. Yes, the idea of the project is to identify all of the genes that make up a human. And why this was going to be really important was that then if people are having negative consequences in life based on genes, then it would offer the future opportunity of genetic engineering. Once we identify all the genes that make a human, we can identify the genes for all the different traits, and that people can actually engineer themselves or engineer their offspring to create the kind of life that we would like to have, you know. And this is actually the fulfillment of the mission statement of science, to dominate and control nature. And it's interesting because the Human Genome Project was envisioned to be the last major biology project of all time, because once all the genes were known, and we know that DNA goes to RNA goes to protein, and that the genes as DNA would be the control devices, the rest of science would be just taking that information, learning how to turn it into technology, wherein we can genetically engineer people, plants, and animals, and create that world that we would really like to have. Well, that was actually what I thought was the basis of the Human Genome Project, a humanitarian effort. It was interesting later to find out from Paul Silverman, one of the principal architects of the Human Genome Project, that that actually wasn't what the project was all about. What it was all about was simply this. It was estimated that there was going to be over 100,000 genes in the human genome because automatically we go back to the premise that the proteins in our body, the building blocks, are made by genes. There's a different gene for each different protein building block. There are over 100,000 different proteins, so by nature there was going to be over 100,000 different genes. Plus, there were even genes that didn't make proteins but controlled the other genes. Those were called regulatory genes, and it was estimated that there were anywhere from 20 to 50,000 of those. So before the project got off the ground, the scientists were given these secure facts. Number one, there was going to be in excess of 100,000, maybe 150,000 different genes. That once we identify these specific genes, that we could then use these genes in genetic engineering experiments and correct the ills and problems that face humans in this world. Well, again, it started out as that we were going to do this for humanitarian purposes. It turns out, as Paul Silverman said, actually that wasn't the design behind the Human Genome Project. That actually the project was designed by venture capitalists for this reason. They figured that there were over 100,000 genes, that by identifying these genes and then patenting the gene sequences, that they could then sell the gene patents to the drug industry, and that the drug industry would use the genes in creating health products. So that, in fact, it was very interesting, is that the program wasn't actually for advancing the human state as much as it was for making a lot of money. And that the interesting fact was that since the Human Genome Project, every gene that has been identified has since been patented as well, and that there's been an effort to try to sell these patents to drug industry for drug discovery purposes. But here's the fun part about it. The Human Genome Project got off the ground with knowing. They knew the DNA controlled life. They knew that the proteins were blueprinted by the DNA. They knew that if you go up the evolutionary scale, that simple organisms had less DNA, and when you get to the level of humans with the kind of complexity of our physiology and our behavior, that we would have a lot more DNA, so that primitive organisms would have maybe a few thousand genes, but by the time you get to the human, we're going to have 150,000 genes approximately, which in their mind meant 150,000 new drugs. So the project gets off the ground in 1987. And it actually is a very effective project, and it just really shows, again, when humans really put their heads together, they can create miracles. I mean, it was sort of like when Kennedy said we would go to the moon and made that a concerted effort. Within the decade, we end up with a rocket ship on the moon. And what's interesting about the Human Genome Project, it was one of those unfathomable projects until we decided this was going to be the effort. And then in about 14 years, we actually had the results of the human genome. And it's been a very exciting process, but it also was what I call a cosmic joke. Cosmic joke to me is when you can bet everything, including the kitchen sink, that something is going to turn right, and as soon as you make the bet, that thing turns left. So cosmic joke is when you think you actually really fully understand and know everything with such surety that all of a sudden the universe turns around and sort of gives you that little funny sense of black humor where just when you think you know it, you actually don't. Well, this happened in the Human Genome Project. It was another one of those very famous global cosmic jokes, and it goes like this. To start the Human Genome Project, first, rather than working on humans, the idea was to work on more simple organisms so that you can get a working knowledge of how to compile the amount of information required for a Human Genome Project. Remember, the Human Genome Project is to identify the genes. The genes are the sequences of A, T, C, and G, which are the blueprints for the proteins. There are billions of A, T, C's, and G's used in the code, so it's a very large project. Billions of these bases make up the genetic code. So they started with a primitive organism. The primitive organism they use has a fancy Latin name called Caenorhabditis elegans. Caenorhabditis elegans is a miniature worm with only about 1,240 some cells that make up the entire worm. So it's a very small organism. It's barely visible with your eye. It's at the level of, just a small portion of a millimeter. The relevance of why they worked with the Caenorhabditis is because Caenorhabditis has been an experimental animal for geneticists, because you can breed them, they reproduce very quickly and in very large numbers, and they express behavioral traits that you can study. So this makes a wonderful genetic model. And as such, because it has been a genetic model, was one of the first organisms whose genome was to be studied. When they finally finished this project, they found that this small animal that's comprised of about, as I said, over 1,200 some cells, that this animal had a genome of about 24,000 genes. And they said, well, cool, this is cool because we expect something. It's a small animal. When we get to the human, we'll have 100 plus thousand genes. Everything is cool. The technology of the Human Genome Project is now being established with the Caenorhabditis and appears to work. They decided to do one more genetic model, though, before doing the human. And that was the fruit fly, or the Drosophila. And now most of us have done experiments in high school or college breeding fruit flies and are familiar with the fact that the fruit fly has been one of the darlings of the genetic community for almost 100 years. So, of course, it was ripe for being picked to have its genome looked at very early in the game because of the amount of information and science on the genetics and behavior of fruit flies. So they start to do the genome of the fly, and here's an interesting fact. Remember, the belief system of science is that genes control the characters, that a primitive organism will have fewer genes and more advanced, more complex organisms will have proportionally more genes making up their genome. The first organism they did was the barely visible small little roundworm called Caenorhabditis elegans, and it had 24,000 genes. And then they complete the Drosophila genome and find out this organism, which is hundreds of times bigger and infinitely more complex than the worm, has only about 18,000 genes. And this was a big shock because they said, wait, according to our belief system, as you get into more complex organisms, you're going to have more genes. And what they found is that the primitive worm had 24,000 genes, and this flying machine called Drosophila had only 18,000 genes. And they didn't understand what that meant, but at that point, they were really so gung-ho to do the Human Genome Project, they just put that on the back burner and said, okay, we'll deal with these issues later. How can a more complex organism have fewer genes? And they start the work on the Human Genome Project. And the Human Genome Project results come in 2001, and it's a major shock. And the reason why it's a major shock is simply this, is that what they find is that in the human genome, there are only about 25,000 genes. They expected over 100,000, near 150,000 genes, and when the project was completed, there were only about 25,000 genes. And it was a big shock, such a shock to the system that people actually didn't talk about it. Well, there was a lot of hoopla. Oh, we completed the Human Genome Project, which they did. No one really talked about the fact of, what about the missing genes? There were over 100,000 missing genes, meaning if the belief system, which we really bought into about how life works, required over 100,000 genes, how can you explain a human being with only 25,000 genes, 1,000 genes more than the most primitive organism, the animal they studied, the Caenorhabditis elegans? It didn't make any sense. Matter of fact, what was so interesting about it was that there was a complete lack of discussion in the scientific journals about the absence of all these genes. It threw a monkey wrench into the system because it said there was no way then to understand the complexity of a human only on 25,000 genes. Especially using the belief system that we were coming with. So it was interesting because while I had been realizing that genes were not the complete story because my cells in my tissue cultures were being more or less controlled by the environment, there was a component of the environment that has not been considered. Well, when the Genome Project came out and they realized there were not enough genes to account for human complexity, it really shook the foundation of biology, although it wasn't really publicly discussed. It was almost like an embarrassment as to, well, how can you get a human with so few genes? And so really what we started to recognize was that the genetic sky was falling. And I was out there like Chicken Little saying, oh, the genetic sky is falling. And people look at me, yeah, but you're Chicken Little. And it was interesting because in the issue of the Human Genome Project that was published in the journal Nature, there was an article by David Baltimore. David Baltimore is a Nobel Prize winning geneticist. So in this particular case, he's Chicken Big. And David Baltimore brought this one particular point up in a few short paragraphs. He said, how can we explain the characters of human biology? Are things such as our consciousness and our ability to make complex changes in our physiology and account for all of our physiology and our biology with so few genes? And what David Baltimore started to realize was that we really don't have an understanding about what causes humanness to come from genes. And this was the first admission from the head of science, in a sense, or at least he being a Nobel Prize winning geneticist, as a spokesperson for the genetics community, to say, there's something awry here. We don't understand what is responsible for human complexity. And this is such a wonderful point of view because he was the first to actually admit that while other people were playing with it. Why is this so important? Well, the interesting thing is, for me as a person who was teaching in a medical school, why this was important is simply this. Let's just stop for a second and consider a piece of logic. If a healing modality is basing its healing practice on the way that science actually works, the way that nature actually works, then by using that healing modality, it should be a benefit to the patients. In contrast, if a healing modality is based on principles that are not supported by science, then it is likely that this healing modality would actually be a detriment when applied to a patient. So it basically says if a science is based on the way life really works, that science would be good for you to be used in a medical practice, and that if you base your science on wrong information, then that science could be detrimental. And then when we consider that, then we step back and look at something that has not really been voiced very much, but has been a major concern in my life, and that is this. It is a recognized fact that conventional allopathic medicine, the medicine we use in Western civilization, is contributing to being the leading cause of death in the United States, for example. It's also responsible for 1 out of 5 deaths in Australia. That we're beginning to find that the medical profession is actually quite a scary situation because it is the leading cause of death. And the significance about that is that it was first recognized to be the third leading cause of death by medicine itself. In the Journal of the American Medical Association, Dr. Barbara Starfield wrote an article revealing that from conservative estimates, the practice of medicine is responsible for the third leading cause of death in the United States. It's called iatrogenic illness, meaning illness related from hospital or medical treatment, meaning a patient goes in with a problem A, but dies from problem B, something that is a result of medical treatment. So iatrogenic illness is even recognized by the medical association to be the third leading cause of death. However, there's a more recent study by Gary Null. His last name is N-U-L-L. He has a website, GaryNull.com, where his article, Death by Medicine, is published. Gary and several other medical doctors got together and said, the work by Barbara Starfield said that the numbers she provided were based on conservative estimates. And Gary Null said, wait, rather than estimates, what if I just go make a real complete listing of all of the deaths that arise from medical treatment? When Gary did this, he found that rather than being the third leading cause of death, that iatrogenic illness is the first leading cause of death, with over 750,000 people dying from medical treatment. And why this is relevant, of course, is that what it really reflects is a point of logic, that if medicine actually knew what it was doing, it wouldn't be that lethal. And it now stands up in the light of the Human Genome Project is that we are still teaching the belief that genes control life, and that genes are responsible for all the characters and traits. And yet, the Human Genome Project now, several years ago, has revealed that there are not enough genes to do that, that the genes cannot control for human complexity. And so, as a result, we are perpetuating a belief which we know is scientifically invalid. genes do not necessarily control life. Well, now I take a step back and say, okay, I'm teaching genes control life to medical students. And yet while I'm doing that, I'm growing these cells in tissue culture and identifying that the cells are responding to the environment and their fate is more or less in the hands of the environment.